Okay, good morning, everybody. And thank you very much for joining us once again. Does everyone have a source sheet? If not, there are plenty of extras, so please raise your hand if you don't have one. For this new series of the Women's Halacha class that we're going to be having, just for your information, it's the same class last night as we're having this morning, because there were many who said they weren't able to make it at nights, many who said they weren't able to make it in the mornings. So we're going to give the same option both, so that everyone can full advantage. I've decided to try and examine and understand each week a particular halachic topic that stems from the weekly parsha. And the reason why I thought this was an interesting thing to do is because it will give us both an insight into the halacha, it will make us backtrack the real underpinnings of the halacha and understand where the halacha actually stems from and which psukim actually we derive the halacha from. Obviously, we know halacha is not in a vacuum. Halacha comes from somewhere, and most of our halacha is based off of psukim. So that's something that we need to focus on and understand where the background of the halacha actually is from. And not only that, but it also gives us an appreciation and a understanding of the richness of what lays beneath the simple understanding of the psukim that we read. When it comes to Parshas Noach, obviously there's a lot to talk about. There are many directions in which to go. But the particular topic that I chose this morning is one which is very personal to all of us at this time, and I think it's a very sensitive topic in its nature. As we know, the last couple of weeks, the Jewish people find themselves once again in a very difficult battle, in a horrific battle with our enemies, from many different sides, who have chosen to take advantage of us and have chosen to question our faith by what they're doing. I think it's fair to say that many of us think about the words that we say in Hallel every single day of Sukkot, that we said, Lama yomer hagoyim aye Eloheim. How long can the nations of the world question? And for that matter, how long can we question, where is God's hand in all of this? And it's a difficult question, and I think many of us struggle with it. It's something I struggle with, and I think most people that I know have a difficult time understanding this. How is it possible to see God's kindness? How is it possible to see God's mercy? And how is it possible to understand what he's doing to us when we see all of these brutally murderous attacks, the relentless stabbings that are going on in Israel? Every day we turn on the news, every day we look at our phones and we see what's happening, and it's just each day is worse than the next. So whenever these kinds of difficult times arise, it's important for us, number one, to identify with the crisis that's going on, to identify ourselves and to understand that we are an integral part of everything that's happening. And just because we might live in Chutz La'aretz and just because we might think that we're safe, we are not safe. The Jewish people are under attack, and I believe this is the Jewish people under attack all over the world. And even if we might not feel it as personally here, but we need to make ourselves feel it. We need to put ourselves in the situation, understand the hysteria, understand everything that's going on there. And we have to do our best to assist as much as we can. Now, for some people, that means, giving whatever it is that they can monetarily. For many of us, that's something that's simply not an option, and it's very confusing also. We don't really know who's trustworthy, who's doing good work, who is not, and I'm sure many of them are doing good work, but it's difficult. But obviously, one thing that Chazal tell us that we can do our part is based on the pasuk of Omdos Hayiraglenu B'Sha'arayach Yerushalayim. Chazal learned from that pasuk that Omdos Hayiraglenu, when will our soldiers be able to stand up straight and tall? When will they have their feet, so to speak, at the time Bizban She'arayach Yerushalayim, which is really a reference to the learning of Torah, to the studying of Torah, to our commitment to learning Torah. That is the time when we know that Omdos Hayiraglenu, that is when we know we are going to be assured that our Chayalim, that our Mishtara, that our brothers and sisters who are fighting the battle on the forefront, we may be in the background, but this is how we know that those on the front lines are going to be safe. When we recommit ourselves to Omdos Hayiraglenu B'Sha'arayach Yerushalayim, particularly when we discuss the difficult and very deeply complex topic that we're going to discuss today. And obviously we can't say everything in one shiur, but I just want to give a glimpse of some of the, not frustration, but some of the difficulty that people in Israel actually have to go through, some of the difficult decisions that they have to consider when standing in a time of war like we are right now. And it should give us a small perspective of the issues that we face as a people. So I want to begin like this. We have, in modern history, a couple of Jewish heroes, and I'm sure there are many more. I just want to highlight a few stories, and I want to dissect the halacha behind those stories and figure out whether really what they did should deem them heroes, or maybe perhaps they did something that was inappropriate. So let's begin. There was an incredible Jew by the name of Roei Klein, who was a very young man. He passed away in 2006. He was a member of the Golani Brigade. He was part of the IDF. And when he was together with his soldiers in the Lebanon War in 2006, he saw that the enemy had placed a grenade in front of them that was about to be set off. And he decided to take his own life. He jumped on the grenade in order to save everyone else in his kvutza, in order to save the lives of all those who were with him in his battalion. So is that something, he goes down in history as a major Jewish hero. He saved many, many Jewish lives. But is that something that really we should deem him a hero for? Is that something he was allowed to do, to take life into his own hands? So that's something I want to discuss today. You take more recently, last year we had the unfortunate attack in the Har Nof Shul, and there were many difficult parts to that story, but one major highlight of the story was someone by the name of Rabbi Aryeh Kupinski, and I'm sure there were many more, just we don't have first-hand accounts to really know exactly what took place, but one thing that we do know is there was a man who was a very broad, a very strong person by the name of Rabbi Kupinski, who had every ability to actually walk himself straight out of the shul and be away from the line of fire. But instead, he decided to jump right in. And he decided to save the lives of others by putting his own life on the line and ultimately losing his own life. You take, let's say, last week, Rabbi Lavi, who was an Ateret Kohanim, he was sitting simply in his own home enjoying his meal with his family, and he hears somebody being stabbed downstairs. He could have stayed safe in his home, but he decided to jump in. He went outside, he went downstairs, and he lost his life. Is this something which would deem them heroes? Is this something which we should really look at and say, wow, these people are the prototypical Jews, they are the most amazing Jews, they're the people we should put up on a pedestal? Or do we say, perhaps it was an inappropriate choice that they made to take life into their own hands? Now, this is something which is a very difficult topic to discuss, but it's something that I think should put us a little bit in the mindset of what's actually happening in the state of Israel, in the land of Israel right now. So I want to break this up into three major components. And one is, how much is one obligated to sacrifice of themselves in order to save other people, both monetarily and physically? Question number two is, what is the source of the prohibition for somebody to take life into their own hands, to commit suicide? And as difficult as that question is, it's something that is a rich literature in halacha. There's a lot written about this. And number three, are there particular exceptions to the rule when we would assume that perhaps ma'abed atzmo ladas, as we call it, somebody taking their own life, ladas means with your own mind, you choose to take your own life. Are there perhaps circumstances when we would assume that ma'abed atzmo ladas would be permissible? Ma'abed atzmo ladas are the three words on the top of the page. And what that means is a person taking life into their own hands, a person taking their own life based on a decision that they have made. So are there perhaps times when this is permissible? Are there perhaps times when this is obligatory? And this is something I want to just discuss. We don't have that much time, but I just want to give the highlights of what this question is all about. And you'll understand a little bit of the difficulty that lays behind. Just take for another example. There was a major discussion after the whole story, the terrible story of Gilad Shalit. And we know that, thank God, we don't have to make those choices. We don't run the country. We don't have to make the decision whether or not we should give up everything that we gave up to get him back, or whether the whole country should turn upside down for one soldier. It's a very difficult question, and it's not a simple one. The rule happens to be in the Israeli army that they will do anything to bring a soldier back alive, and I think even dead, if I'm not mistaken. Now, that has major consequences. And as we know, many of those terrorists who were released have gone back and began to do new terrorist activities. They've re-inculcated themselves into their communities, they have rejuvenated themselves, and now all of a sudden they're back and doing the same thing that they did before. So it's a very difficult question, it's a very difficult decision. The reason the Israeli army does that is because they believe that it builds the moral support of the Israeli soldiers when they know that they will always be saved, they will always be brought back at any cost. That makes you want to fight harder. If you know that your country is always behind you, it gives you the confidence to be able to fight the enemy as best as you possibly can. So after that terrible story happened, and then ultimately after a couple of years and he was released, so there was a major survey that was taken in Israel. I don't remember the numbers, I didn't have a chance to look it up, but I remember that there was a survey that came out that they asked young 18-year-old soldiers, boys, both men and women who were going enlisting into the army for the first time, they asked them, what would you do now? Would you choose to have the whole country stand on its head the same way we did for Gilad Shalit, because we respect the dignity of every soldier and we will do everything to bring them back? Or would you take a cyanide pill as you're about to see that you're being captured by the enemy? How difficult of a question is this that we have to ask 18-year-olds enlisting into the army which one they would prefer? Would you prefer to suffer and perhaps give away secrets to the enemy? Or would you prefer perhaps to take a cyanide pill and kill yourself? And this was a major question, and the overwhelming majority of the people who were asked this question responded that they would take the pill. Now, is that a correct decision? Is that something that's permissible? Is that something we should condemn? Is that something we should perhaps encourage? These are really difficult questions, and these are questions that arise every single day. And you shouldn't just think it's theoretical. These are questions that are dealt with by this most serious halachic literature that's out there nowadays. I know that Rav Asher Weiss nowadays answers many, many shilas for the Mossad, and there are so many difficult questions. You have a lot of literature that's written about Malkota Devash, take for example. Malkota Devash means in English a honey trap. So they'll send a married woman into an Arab village to live with this man for months and for years perhaps, getting all sorts of secrets out of this man. And it turns out that you have a married woman, or even a single girl. You have a Jewish married woman or a single woman who is going and living completely with an Arab, but she has to do that in order for the country to be safe. Is that something that's permissible? Is that something that we would allow? All these kinds of very difficult questions are questions that are actually dealt with and written about. So I just want to invite you to join me in understanding a little bit of these kinds of issues and understand a little bit the complexity of what the decision-making process is when we face these kinds of issues. So let's begin with the first entry on the source sheet, and that is a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin Gimel Amud Beis. The Gemara says, Minayin, hopefully, in the coming weeks, our topics will be a little more, I can't say interesting, but upbeat, a little more of a happy tone, but for now, I think it's important that we identify a little bit with what's happening. So the Gemara says in Sanhedrin Ayin Gimel, and obviously this has to do with the weekly Parsha also, everything that we're going to discuss stems directly from this week's Parsha. So we'll see in a couple of minutes, but let's just see by way of introduction. Minayin l'roz chavera shehu tovea benahar. Says the Gemara, let's say I'm walking by an ocean, I'm walking by a river. Oh, for those who are confused, the second side of the page, what I like to do is give out something that can be repeated at a Shabbos table, Parshas Noach. So this has nothing to do with our shir. It is just something nice to discuss at your Shabbos table. If we have enough time at the end of the shir, I will say something briefly about that. But if not, everyone can take it home and read it on their own. So every week I try to do that and give you something to take home. So let's get back to the Gemara. Minayin l'roz chaver shehu tovea benahar. How do you know that if you see somebody, you happen to be walking by an ocean, a swimming pool, and you see somebody who's drowning, and they're about to lose their life, unfortunately, how do you know? Let's say you see somebody who's being devoured by an animal, by a wild animal. Now, that's a very unusual story, but still, what's the halach in such a case? You see somebody, armed robbers are on top of them, you see, or take, for example, our situation now. You see somebody in the street, there is an enemy attacker on top of them, stabbing them, shooting them, whatever it is. How do you know that you have to jump in and get involved? Ask the Gemara this question, which is the question that we're bothered with. How do you know shehu chayiv lahatzilo? How do you know that you are obligated to get involved? Now, what does that mean, obligated to get involved? Does obligated to get involved mean I stand on my roof and I do something that doesn't put my own life in danger? Or does obligated to be involved means you go outside, you get involved, and you put your own life on the line? So that's not clear yet, but let's see. The Gemara just wants to know generally, how do I know that I have to get involved? Because it says, lo sa'amod al dam re'echa. You cannot stand by idly while somebody else is losing their life. And because we have this pasuk, lo sa'amod al dam re'echa, we learn that you always have to do whatever you can to help save the life of others. Now, if you take the Gemara on a very simple level, that means you have to do whatever you can, which means if I happen to be on a safari and somebody is getting devoured by the lion, take for example, so I happen to have a tranquilizer because I always walk around with something like that, so I can go and shoot the animal to make sure that this person doesn't get hurt. Okay, that's not putting my life in danger at all. That's all I see from the Gemara, that I cannot just put a blind eye and say, walk away and mind your own business and don't worry about what other people are doing. That is not permissible. But from the Gemara, you do not see anything about how much risk a person has to take. Now the Gemara goes a little further. And the Gemara says, why do we need a new pasuk of Lo Samud Al Dam Re'echa to teach you this halacha that you always have to do your best to look out for other people and make sure to take care of them? Don't we know that we have a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda? And if the same applies to Hashavas Aveda, that you have to actually give somebody back their pocketbook, their wallet, if they lose it, you have to go and look for the rightful owner, then certainly if somebody's losing their own life, you also have to make sure to return themselves to themselves. So why do I need a new pasuk to teach me, lo sa'amod al dam re'echa, that you have to make sure not to stand by idly while someone else is in a dangerous, precarious situation? Why don't you just learn it from the pasuk of Hashavas Aveda? Why do we need a new pasuk to teach you this? Answers the Gemara as follows, skip to the last line. Imei hasam, if I only would have had the pasuk of Hashavas Aveda, that would not be enough. Why? Because here, my obligation when somebody's life is on the line goes above and beyond my obligation to return somebody's lost item, and that is, if I only had the pasuk of Hashavas Aveda Hava Amina, I would have said, Hani Mili Benafshe. Hashavas Aveda dictates that I have to do my best to go and return the lost item to its rightful owner. However, Avol Mitrach Umeger Agure Emalo, who said that for returning somebody their life, maybe if I happen to have a tranquilizer, I can shoot the animal. If I happen to know how to swim, I should jump into the pool to save that person. But who said if I don't know how to swim? Who said that I have to go ahead and hire a lifeguard if I see a lifeguard running by the pool and I say, I'll pay you $100,000 to go save this person? Am I responsible to do that also? Is that also part of my obligation? For Hashavas Aveda, I wouldn't have to do that. If somebody loses a pocketbook, I don't have to say, well, let's hire detectives for $100,000 and figure out how to get it back to you. It's not worth it. But how do you know that you would even have to hire somebody to go and save the other person? Says the Gemara, that's why we have a new pasuk, that your obligation when somebody's life is on the line goes way above and beyond the obligation when somebody has lost their own personal item. So that's what the Gemara tells us. Now, if you stop right there, the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam, Paskin, like this Gemara, that not only when somebody's life is in danger, not only do you have to try and save them on your own, you even have the obligation to go and find somebody else to save their life as well, even if it's going to cost money. If I would have stopped there, I would have said, even if it's going to cost me money. Right? If the only way to save somebody's life is to pay $100,000 to get them out of that drowning situation into the river, I have to go do my best to save their life. I have to go even pay $100,000 to save them. That's what I would have said. But the Rishonim over there on that Gemara explain not the way we would have said. Excuse me. The Rishonim say that Gemara is not to be taken literally. The Rishonim say, if I successfully save that person from the bottom of the ocean, if I successfully get the animal off of that person and they are no longer in danger, they now, the victim who is saved, now has to pay for the service that I rendered them. It's not my obligation. I was a good Samaritan, but I don't have to pay for it. When he is saved, he has to go ahead and pay the person who saved him. That's what the Rishonim explained in the Gemara, which is obviously not the simple understanding if we would have just read the Gemara on our own. I would have said, I have an obligation not only to save him, but also to pay for it. The Gemara says, no. If I ultimately save that person by hiring somebody else, that hiring has to be paid by the one who is now saved. That's what the Gemara tells us. Now, the question is, that person never hired the individual to save them. So what obligation do they have? Let's say somebody comes to my home, and we'll get into this in a couple of minutes. Somebody comes to my home and decides to refurbish my whole house. Did I ever hire them? No, I don't have to pay them. I didn't ask them to do the job. They decided to come on their own. I don't have an obligation to pay them. We'll see in a minute. It's not so clear. But why do they have an obligation? Obviously, you feel fortunate that your life was saved. Obviously, you're happy. But who said that you have to pay $100,000 to this lifeguard who jumped in to save you because that was the condition? You didn't make that condition with the lifeguard. Somebody else made the condition. So why do I have to pay if I'm now ultimately saved? Fair question? So it gets us to a larger issue. And let's look at the second entry, which is a Gemara Bab Metzia Daf Kuf Aleph. Would people rather that we don't read the sources or that we do? For those who want us to read the sources, can you raise your hand? Okay. Because if it's uncomfortable, we can just speak them all out and forget the source sheet. I always find that the source sheet helps people pay attention because you can take some notes along the way. So the Gemara writes in Bab Metzia Daf Kuf Aleph, let's say I go to Israel for 6 months. I'm on a sabbatical. I had enough of the shul already. I go, right? It's been too long, 3 months. And I decide I need a year sabbatical. So I go to Israel, but I leave my property here. I have somebody, I hire him to go mow the lawn every week and take care of everything. But while I'm gone, you'll never believe it. Somebody shows up, builds a hotel in my backyard, and then after a year I decide, you know, I'm really enjoying this, I may as well stay for another year. So I'm gone for 2 years. While I'm gone, I have no idea what's happening here. Somebody built a hotel in my backyard. It turns out this hotel is the only hotel in Woodmere, and everyone's coming to take out rooms. We're making a major business out of this hotel. All of a sudden I show up 2 years later and I see there's a whole business going on in my backyard. I see this hotel is generating a lot of income. Do I have to pay this person now for doing me this favor? Well, on the one hand, I never asked them to build a hotel in my backyard. On the other hand, well, I'm making a lot of money. So the Gemara tells us clearly in Bab Metzia Daf Kuf Aleph, Hayorid the Toch Ste Chaveiro, Vinata Shaloberschus. Let's say somebody walks into my property and I didn't ask them to, and they do something which is amazingly beneficial to me. They build a hotel in my property, which obviously is going to generate income. And it is generating income, and I'm not losing anything, I'm only making money. I have to pay them, says the Gemara, even though I didn't hire them. Ask the Rishonim there. Why is that the case? You didn't hire the person to build the hotel for you. If somebody comes and mows my lawn, do I have to pay them? I didn't ask you to do the service. Maybe I would have been happy with having grass that's out of control. So why do I have to pay if somebody comes and builds a hotel on my property? And not only that, we have another Gemara in Sanhedrin where the Gemara says, take for example, let's say I'm in Israel for the year and there's a word that goes around town that, what's a good example? That there's a, let's say, what did we have a couple of years ago? Not the crickets. What were they called again? Cicadas, right? So let's say there was a way to save yourself from the cicadas. I don't know. I don't remember the whole story. But let's say they come into your property, they're going to destroy everything. I happen to have a wonderful neighbor who knows that I'm away for the year and says, you know, I should really go ahead and do something to make sure the cicadas don't ruin my neighbor's property while he's away. So let me make sure I'll go and I'll spray some pesticide, I'll spray whatever it is, I'll make sure to do something to make sure that the animals, that the cicadas, that these insects don't come into my friend's property. And now I come home and it turns out my property is the same way it was before when I left. And the reason why that happened is because in the interim, somebody decided to get involved and make sure that the cicadas don't come to destroy my property. So do I have to pay them for that? Says the Gemara, no. You don't have to pay. So what's the difference? How do you draw the line? How do you figure out? When I don't hire someone, but they do something that is beneficial to me. On the one hand, if they stop the cicadas from coming in, I don't have to pay them. If he builds a hotel on my property, I do have to pay him. If I'm drowning in the river and somebody else hires somebody to come and get me, I have to pay for that service even though I didn't ask for it. So how do you draw the line? How do you figure out when you are obligated to pay? And when we say, well, you didn't hire the person and therefore it's not your obligation. Okay, is that clear? Any questions? So this is a major question that's discussed in the Rishonim. And the Rishonim answer one of two answers. And it's going to make a major difference, a major distinction in our case, which one of these two answers you adopt. Answer number one is, when do we assume that you have to pay somebody else even though you didn't explicitly hire them? Answer number one is whenever there is a tangible hanah that was given. For example, the person comes into my property and does something substantive that I can actually point a finger at. They build a hotel on my property and it's there. So if that's something that's a tangible benefit that I can actually see, that I can actually point to, so even though I didn't ask you to do it, but if it's something that's tangible, I have to pay for it because it's still there. That's answer number one. And therefore we assume, if you do something to make sure that the cicadas don't come into my property, well, there's nothing tangible that's there, and that's why you don't have to pay for it. But if you build a hotel on my property, since there's something tangible that's actually there, therefore I must pay for it. That's answer number one. Answer number two, and this is a totally different suggestion, is whenever there is a umdana demuchach, which means whenever it's beyond the shadow of a doubt, that any normal person in their right state of mind would say, I would like you to do this, then it's as if I explicitly hired you. For example, if somebody would come to me and make a proposal, I'm going to build a hotel on your property and it's going to generate $1 million income every year. Okay, so I wouldn't let them do it because I don't believe them. But let's say they did it and now the hotel is actually generating $1 million income. Is there any question in my mind that I would allow that? Of course I would allow it. Not only that, I would hire them to do it. So in a case like that, whether it's a umdana demuchach, where it's obvious and it's clear that any normal person would have wanted this, then you have to pay for that service. But let's say you have the issue of the cicadas. Okay, some people pay for the service, some people wouldn't. It's not such a big loss. What am I losing already? My landscaping? Big deal. So it's not so clear that everybody would invest in that service. So in a case like that, if I didn't ask you explicitly to do me that favor, you don't have to come through. I don't have to pay you. Clear? Now, one major difference would be the following. The Ramah discusses the following issue. For those who are married in the room or were married, we know that there's a concept of shadchanus. We know that we're supposed to pay a shadchan. Now, we shouldn't just think this is a nice gesture. The Chafetz Chaim, as we know, on Sukkis, you have to buy the dalad minim, have to belong to you. You need shelachem. So we say, this is a whole question, if you're allowed to give a check, maybe a check is only an obligation. It doesn't really belong to me because the person may have not cashed the check yet. There are those who are careful to pay only with cash. Everyone goes crazy about the dalad minim. So, what's the halacha? The Chafetz Chaim was careful. He said, we are so unclear about so much of the money that we make during the year. Was I really entitled to make that money? I have a job. And here I am, I'm talking on the phone the whole time, I'm sending emails. Do I really have the right to the money that I'm being paid from the job? Do I really give it all my all? Do I give it all of my energy? And it's a major question. And it's something that's a difficult question for us to answer. And the Chafetz Chaim said, I want to make sure that my dalad minim actually belongs to me. You know which money I'm going to use? He used to save up the money that people gave him during the year for Shadchanus. People gave him money when he made a Shidduch because he said that's the only money that is rightfully deserved 1,000%. That's the only money that I know throughout the year that I absolutely deserve every penny of it. And that's how the Chafetz Chaim is what I want to use when I buy my Dalad Minim to make sure they're really mine. So Shadchanus is a real thing. And the question is, why is it a real thing? Did I ask the Shadchan to make my Shidduch? I didn't hire them to do the service for me. So why do I have to pay them? Doesn't this tie into our situation? If somebody's drowning and a lifeguard says, I'm only going to save them for $100,000, that person didn't hire me. Somebody else hired me. Do I have to pay them? Well, over here as well, if a Shadchan decides and their own Good Samaritan decides that they want to save my life and get me married, they want to make sure to find me the right person to marry, why do I have to pay them? I didn't hire that person. So if you make up with a Shadchan in advance, hey, if you get me married, it's $10,000, great. But what if I don't make anything up in advance and the person on their own decides to make my Shidduch? Why do I have to pay them? And this is a question that's discussed in the Rishonim. Well, the answer is, it depends on one of these two answers. If you assume that the determining factor, the only time you have to pay somebody for doing a service for you, if you didn't ask them to do it, is only when there's shvach be'en, is only when there is a tangible, a substantive benefit that we can point our finger at, well, the Shadchan didn't create the boy or girl. All the Shadchan did was made a few phone calls. All they did was send a few emails, and now it turns out that their hishtadlus, that their phone calls, their emails actually got me married. But they didn't create anything that I could point a finger at, and therefore, if everything is determined by that, I would not have to pay the Shadchanus money. However, if we assume like the second answer of Tosis, that the way we determine it, when do I have to pay somebody for a benefit that they give me, even though I didn't ask them, is when it's an umdina demuchach, when it's clear that any normal person in their right mind would have paid to have this service done. Well, over here, assuming that the marriage is a good marriage, over here, any normal person would have paid. If I had known that this Shadchan was the one who was going to take care of me, I would have paid them to find me the Shidduch years earlier. Correct? So if that's the determining factor, then I obviously have to pay a Shadchan, even though there's no tangible benefit that is rendered to me. There's no tangible service that I can point a finger at. And this is the way we paskin, this is the way the Ramah assumes, that when you have something that anyone in the right mind would have asked somebody else to do, then you have to pay for that service, even if you didn't explicitly ask. And this is the reason why you have to pay a Shadchan. This is the reason why, this is the reason why somebody who goes and builds a hotel on my property while I'm away, this is why I have to pay them, even though I didn't hire them, even though there was no contract, no agreement, no deal. And this is why, when you have the cicada case, you wouldn't have to, because that's not so clear whether or not everybody would have wanted that service to be rendered. Okay, so now let's move a little bit further. What about if we're not talking about an issue of money? Everything we've discussed till now is how much money do I have to spend in order to save someone's life? The answer is seemingly nothing, because really that person, if they're saved, has to pay for the service that I took care of to save their life. Now, what about risking my own life when somebody else's life is in danger? Now, this is a major question that is dealt with in the Rishonim as well. There are those who are of the opinion, there are those who feel that you have to do everything. If you see somebody in a line of fire, and they will for sure lose their life if you don't intervene, and you will questionably lose your life if you intervene, right? It's not 100% you're going to be a victim. You have to get involved. There are those who assume that way. What's fascinating is that although there is a school of thought that believes this way, the Shulchan Aruch does not say that. The Shulchan Aruch, when it paskins lahalacha, does not suggest that a person is obligated to put their own life in a suffix sakana, in the line of fire, in order to save someone else. We do not find that to be halacha lemaisa. And the question is, why not? Why is that the case? If you look in, let's begin like this. You look in Parshas Noach, that's the third entry on the source sheet. We have a pasuk in this week's parsha that just to explain the simple words of the pasuk are very difficult. The pasuk says, "Ach es dimchem lenafshoseichem edrosh." What does it mean? I, God, will hold you accountable for your blood. What does that mean? Rashi explains, based on the Gemara, Af al pi shehitarti lachem nitilas neshama bibehema. Even though I put human beings in charge of the world, and they have every right, even though the animal rights activists don't like to hear this, but we have been given every right to kill animals in order to have benefit from them, in order to make shoes, in order to make clothing, in order to make coats, in order to eat meat. We have every right to do that. Even though I have given you that right to take the lives of animals for your own benefit, for your own pleasure, however, as dimchem, your own blood, edrosh me'ashofech dam etzmo, I will hold that person accountable who decides to take their own life and commit suicide. Somebody who decides to take life into their own hands will be held accountable by God. This is what the Gemara says. And I want to get into the parameters of what exactly this means. Rashi is quoting from the Gemara Baba Kama, Daf Tzadi Aleph, but the Rambam talks about this as well in a couple of places, and I just want to highlight one line. We won't go through it now, number Dalid, but you look at the second half of number Dalid, the second half of that statement. The Radvaz, who is a commentary on the side of the Rambam, writes, why is it that I don't have a right? If God gave me money, right? So I have every right to go and invest the money, to take risks. Why do I have a right to put in the stock market? If God decided I should have $1 million this year, what right do you have to risk that $1 million? Maybe God said, be happy with what you have, and that's it. Why do I have a right? Yet, we know God gave us the money, we can do whatever we want with it. If I want, I can throw it in the garbage. I could cut up the dollar bills. You can do whatever you want. So why is it that I don't have that right to take a risk with my life as well? Why do we say that God holds us accountable? If God gives us a right to invest our money, to play around with the stocks, then why don't I also have the right to play around with my life? And the Radvaz explains, look at the second half, it's a very powerful statement. She'ein nafsho shel adam kinyano. Because our lives do not belong to us. God gave us life that we should do wonderful things in that life that he gave us, in those days that we're so fortunate to have. And therefore he says, Ela kinyan HaKadosh Baruch Hu shenemar hanofashos li heina. God put us on this world to do a job. And what right do you think you have to go and start playing with your life and risking your life when you know that you might be shortchanging God on the job that he has asked you to do in this world? And that's why it's not comparable at all to investing our money. God gave us money, do whatever you want with it, it's yours. But God gave you life, you don't have a right to do whatever you want with it. God told you there's a way you're supposed to be living your life, and there are things that you're supposed to be accomplishing in your life. And for you to take life into your own hands is something that, as dimchem lenafshoseichem edrosh, God himself says, I will hold you accountable if you play around with your own life. Not only that, this is something that we take so seriously. If you look in the fifth of the entry on the source sheet, we have a Maseches Smachos, which is in the times of the Mishnayos and the Gemara. Hama'abed atzma ladas. Listen how seriously we take this kind of prohibition of somebody committing suicide. Hama'abed atzma ladas. Ein misaskin imo l'chol davar. What does that mean? Somebody who takes their own life, we do not pay any attention to that person. Let them rot. We don't bury them. We don't deal with them. This is considered a serious offense to God himself. It means you don't value the life that God decided to give you. Now we'll get into the parameters in a few minutes. I just want to make you understand how seriously and avera we take this. It's not by many people that we say such a thing. Someone who's mechal Shabbos the whole life, it doesn't say you can't bury them in the cemetery. It doesn't say that we ignore them. Obviously, even if someone violates terrible atrocities in their life, terrible averas, we still pay attention to them. We still make sure to give them the dignity, the honor that they deserve. But over here, Hama'abed Atzma Ladas seems to be in a different league, in a different category. And not only that, Ein Korim, we don't rip Kriya, Ein Maspidin Alav, we don't have a Levaya, we don't have a Hespid, we don't sit Shiva, we don't do anything. And not only that, there's a famous pitgam, there's a famous saying, Hama'abed Atzma Ladas Ein Lo Chelek La'olam Haba. Somebody who takes life into their own hands and commits suicide loses their portion in the world to come. Now there's a major debate, major discussion in the 1800s where exactly that phrase comes from and whether really it's true. And that's God's job to decide whether or not he's going to give him a portion in the world to come. It's not our problem. But what you see is that we take this very, very seriously. It's an avera that seems to be in a different league than many other averas that a person can commit in their life. Again, if somebody decides to be a Mechal Shabbos their whole life, we'll bury them. We'll give them a funeral. We'll give them a hesped. We'll do everything to show them honor and kavod and dignity that they deserve. But somebody who chooses to take life into their own hands does not deserve that honor because it seems to be an offense to God himself. Now, that being said, we have to go back to our story and figure out if we take this so seriously And if this is something that we don't have a right to choose, hanafashos lihena, like the Radbaz says, our lives belong to God. So what right does Roy Klein have to jump on a grenade? And what right does Rabbi Lavi have to jump in the line of fire and get involved in a situation? He was safe in his own home. Why do we consider them heroes? If they took their life and we assume that we really shouldn't deal with them at all. So why do these people go down in history as heroes? Who said they had the right to do what they did? So in order to answer that question, I want to look at a story in Sefer Shmuel, which is a very difficult one to understand. And this is something that many Mefarshim try to unpackage and try to understand. So let's look through together, read a few psukim. For those who enjoy Tanakh, here you go. So we have a story in Sefer Shmuel, Perek Lamed Aleph. Uplishtim nelchamim b'Yisrael. There was a fight, there was a war going on between the Plishtim, the Philistines, and the Jewish people. Vayanusu anshe Yisrael mepnei haPlishtim. The Jewish people were in hysteria, they were nervous, they were scared, they run away, they retreat. Next pasuk. Vatichbat hamelchama el Shaul. Now all of a sudden, not only does the army that's facing the enemy run away and retreat, but now the enemy is encroaching, and they're coming to Shaul HaMelech, to the king himself. And he realizes, the general of the army, the king of the Jewish people, he realizes he's about to lose his life. And he realizes he's about to be captured. Vayimtzu'uhu hamorim anashim bekeshes. And the people who were standing there with their bows and arrows, that was the warfare at the time, they were standing there about to shoot him. They were about to kill him. Vayachel me'od mehamorim. And he is petrified from the enemy who's right in front of his face. So what happens next? Vayomer Shaul enosei kelev. Listen to what he does, and we have to figure out how this fits into our whole discussion that we've been having. Vayomer Shaul enosei kelev. Shaul says to his trusted advisor, who was always on his right hand, who was always right next to him, Shaul advises him, Shlof charbecha vidakreni ba. I want you to take out your sword and kill me. Penyavo'u ha'arelim ha'ela, because I'm concerned. Maybe the Philistines are going to come, these horrible people, vidakruni, and they will kill me instead of you. Vihis alalubi. It's not clear what that means. They will torture me. They will make a mockery out of me. They'll do something terrible to me, and they will kill me. And now a major disagreement breaks out between Shaul HaMelech and his trusted advisor and his trusted servant. Here the king, who has had this trusted advisor for so many years, is asking that he do him a favor and kill him. And the advisor can't bring himself to do it. How can I do such a thing? I'm a servant. How do you know they're really going to kill you? Maybe some miracle is going to happen. He can't bring himself to do it. And they begin to argue. And he says, I won't do it. And he says, you better do it. And finally, Shaul realizes he's not getting anywhere, and he's running out of time. What does the next pasuk say? V'lo ava nosei kelev ki yari me'od, and vayikach Shaul es hacherev, vayipol aleha. So Shaul decides, if my advisor is not going to do the job for me, I better take life into my own hands. And he takes his own sword, and he commits suicide. He stabs himself. Vayar nosei kelev ki mei Shaul, and those who were carrying the weaponry, the armory of Shaul, see that Shaul has now died. Vayipol gamhu, and he also decides to follow Shaul, and he jumps on the sword, and he also commits suicide. Then the psukim tell us that the war got totally out of control, and then that's the end of the story. And the Mefarshim are really bothered. What right did Shaul HaMelech have to take his life? Who said he can do that? Because he's afraid that the enemy's going to kill him? So what? Is that a right to just take matters into your own hands? We know that God can do anything. God can perform miracles. So what right did Shaul HaMelech have to take life into his own hands? And, for a matter of fact, there are Rishonim who assume that Shaul was wrong. Shaul goes down in history, according to some Rishonim, as being a terrible person. Because he took life, he took matters into his own hands, and he did not have a halachic right to do so. But from the Medrash in our parsha, it seems not that way. The Medrash, when it talks about this terrible crime of committing suicide, the Medrash does say, when do we assume one is not allowed to commit suicide? That is only in a case that is not like Shaul HaMelech. That's what the Medrash says explicitly on our parsha. So it means, Shaul HaMelech did something that was okay, but everybody else is not allowed to do that. unless you're in the circumstances of Shalom Melech. Now, what were the circumstances of Shalom Melech makes us really wonder. Under what conditions, perhaps, would someone be allowed to do what Shalom Melech did? So the Rishonim have a major debate. How do we figure out what was the rationale for Shalom Melech and why he was permitted to do what he did? So some Rishonim say as follows. Shalom Melech was concerned that they were going to capture him and not just kill him right away. They were going to capture him. They were going to go around and tell everybody, look, we captured Shalom Melech, and they were going to proselytize him and make him serve Avodah Zarah. They were going to convert him to whatever religion they believed in. And Shalom Melech was concerned about that. And as we know, there are three Averos that a person has to be willing to give their life up for. What are those? Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim. One, if let's say, Rachmana Litzlan, God forbid, somebody comes to me and says, gun to my head, unless you eat this ham sandwich. I'm allowed to eat the ham sandwich. I don't have to give up my life not to eat Basar B'Cholav, not to eat Chazer. I'm allowed to eat the Basar B'Cholav and save my life. What if somebody comes to me and says, I want you to go and have relations with this person that you're not allowed to live with? I have to be willing to give up my life for that. So over here, Shaul HaMelech understood that not only are they going to capture him, but they're going to make sure that he serves Avodah Zarah as well. And he said, why should I risk that? I know that I'm about to be forced to serve Avodah Zarah. I know that I have to give up my life as not to serve Avodah Zarah, so therefore I may as well just take my own life, and that's why Shaul HaMelech was correct. That's answer number one that some say. There's a major, fascinating discussion. We don't have enough time, but apparently in Spain, in the times of the Rishonim, there was a major debate that took place, and you have to think about what was happening at the time. There was a crusade going on where they did not only want to kill the Jews, but they wanted to try and convert many of the Jewish children, the young Jewish children, to Catholicism or to whatever it was. And at the time, there was a massive fight that took place, and this is documented, where the Rishonim, where the Rabbanim had a major disagreement. There was one Rav who went around killing every child in his community. He went around with a knife, and he killed everybody in his community. And he said, how can we risk the fact that Jewish children are going to be asked to serve Avodah Zarah, and they're not going to know that they're supposed to give up their lives? It's better that we kill them than that they go ahead and give in to this. Can you imagine? And there were other rabbis who came out screaming at this person, who do you think you are? The butcher of Spain. They said the nastiest things about him, and they said, if we are correct, you will die within the next few months. Because what you did is uncalled for, and what you did is unprecedented, and it's something that you had no right to do, and it turns out that he did lose his life. And that seemed to be some sign from heaven that he was incorrect. Because even though, and that's why it's very troubling, this answer, yes, Shaul HaMelech may have wanted to give up his life because he was concerned, maybe they're going to make me serve Avodah Zarah, but who said you have a right to? Maybe you'll wait till they make you do that, and then you'll figure out what to do. Just like that rabbi in Spain who decided to preempt everybody, and he decided he's going to go on the attack, he's going to go on the offensive and kill all the Jewish children. Who said he had a right to do that? And in fact, all the rabbis came out against him. So this is a major questionable answer that's given here as to the rationale of Shaul HaMelech. Let's look at another one. Some other Rishonim suggest, you know why Shaul HaMelech was allowed to do what he did? Simple. Because Shaul HaMelech understood. Can you imagine the uproar? Imagine the rebellion of the Jewish people that is going to be created if they see that their king, that their leader, that their general was just killed by the enemy. They're not just going to take that. Jewish people don't just stand up to that. They're going to make sure to go and rebel even harder. And you know what's going to happen? We're going to lose thousands of Jewish lives as a result. So instead, Shaul HaMelech decided, if I want to take my own life, it's worth it, because this way I'll be saving many thousands of Jews from a massacre, because they're going to go crazy if I'm killed by the enemy. That's answer number two. And answer number three that we find is something that's quoted in the Beis Yosef, and that is a very difficult one. How did Shaul HaMelech allow himself to take life into his own hands? The answer is because Shaul HaMelech was afraid that they were going to torture him. And because he was concerned that they were going to torture him, and he wouldn't be able to withstand this torture, he decided, I'd rather take my life than to live through that torture. Which speaks to the question that the IDF faces. Is a soldier allowed to take a cyanide pill instead of having to suffer through the torture, through the misery that he's about to be put through? And as difficult of a question as it is, it's something that is really spoken about. It's something that's really discussed. Because it's not a simple answer. So over here we have three answers that are given. Number one, Shaul HaMelech perhaps did it because he was afraid they would make him serve Avodah Zarah. Number two, Shaul HaMelech perhaps did it because he knew that he would save thousands of Jewish lives if he took his own life instead of giving his life to the enemy. And answer number three is perhaps Shaul HaMelech was concerned that he wouldn't be able to withstand the misery of the torture that they were about to inflict upon him. Now, the Pischei Tshuva writes on the bottom of the page in Shulchan Aruch Yerodea a very important qualification. When we talk about a suicide, and unfortunately we hear about it so often in the Jewish community, but when we talk about it, the Pischei Tshuva says it's important to keep in mind that the only time we consider this to be a severe avera, a severe criminal act, ach es dimchem l'nav shoseichem edrosh, when do we assume that applies? It's only when somebody does it, kederech hafilosofim, which means, ideologically you believe that this is the right thing to do, that this is the most well-spent life is by taking your own life and giving it to God, like many of the enemies that we face believe. That is the only time, says the Pischei Tshuva, that one would be considered to be a ma'abed atzmo l'das, which gives us major leeway. For example, again, we had that ma'abed atzmo l'das, emes haskenim l'chol davar. Well, what does that mean? How often do we have a case nowadays where a person is actually ma'abed atzmo l'das, unfortunately, and they did it because they believe this is the right thing to do? That's never the case. Usually we assume people do it because they're depressed, they went through some terrible trauma, they can't handle the life that God has given them, they feel that they will not be able to withstand whatever tragedy they're having to overcome, and that's why the person takes their life. In a case like that, we obviously would sit Shiva, we obviously would make sure to give all the dignity to the person that they deserve, because obviously this was a decision that they had to make because they felt that they wouldn't be able to withstand living life any longer. This is something we have to keep in mind. And the Chasam Sofer says not only that, even if you have somebody who takes their own life, kiderech hafilosofim, even if you have somebody who decides ideologically it's the right thing to do, which nowadays we never come across, but even if you have a case like that, the Chasam Sofer writes, but still you have to keep in mind that if it's done, if it's going to cause an embarrassment to the family, that they're not sitting Shiva, that they're not having a Levaya, and they don't want everyone to know exactly what took place, they don't want everyone to know what happened, obviously the Chasam Sofer says you have to take that into account as well. And we have to be able to bend the rules a little bit because of the dignity of the family that's alive, that's going to have to live with this embarrassment. We have to think about that as well. Now this answer of the Rishonim to Shaul HaMelech's justification, why he did what he did, that he was afraid of suffering, is a very bothersome one as well. And that is because we say every day in Psukei Dezimra, Hanosein Sheleg Katsamer. And the simple understanding of that pasuk is that God gives us snow, which looks as beautiful as white fur, right? He puts it out on the ground, and it's so beautiful, and it's so pretty. When we wake up in the morning, we see it snowy outside on the trees. Beautiful, and we're thanking God, we're praising Him for making such a beautiful world, and for the way the world actually runs. However, the Imre Emes said that perhaps there's a different understanding in what this pasuk means. Hanosein Sheleg Katsamer maybe means God gives us sometimes cold and difficult times, difficult circumstances, only katsamer, only according to how much fur, how much wool you have to cover yourself. God will never give us anything that we cannot handle. God will never give us a challenge without giving us also the wherewithal to deal with it. And that, says the Imre Emes, is perhaps what it means. Hanosein sheleg, even though sometimes God metaphorically gives us our snow, our cold days, our difficult times, but it's always katsamer. He always makes sure to give it in direct contrast to how much fur we have to cover ourselves, to keep ourselves warm. And therefore, how can Shaul HaMelech say, I'm afraid that they're going to torture me and I won't be able to withstand? What do you mean? If God puts you in the situation, He'll make sure to take care of you. And it might be difficult, and you might be tortured, but God will give you the strength to endure. So this is a difficult concept. And my father has told me many times that whenever you have a question that has like 10 answers, it means none of them are right. Right? So again, we have the story of Shaul HaMelech. Somehow what he did was the correct thing to do. But let's say, unfortunately, you're the rabbi in Israel who's fielding these questions. You're going to say, well, it depends. If you hold like these Rishonim, you're allowed to take the cyanide pill. If you hold like the other Rishonim, that maybe the rationale of Shaul HaMelech was because he was going to suffer, then you're not allowed to take it. If you're this, you're going to start giving answers like that? Based on a machlokas or Rishonim that doesn't have a clear justification, that we don't really know what the story is. So what right do we have nowadays to have these Jewish heroes jump into the line of fire, put their own lives on the line, when they know that they may lose their lives? What right do they have to do it if we really don't have a clear justification in doing so? And perhaps the answer is as follows. My father has told me on many occasions. We mentioned before that there are three mitzvahs in the Torah that we assume a person has to be willing to give up their life for. And those are Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shfichas Damim. So I ask you the following question, a very simple question. And this is the question that the Minchas Chinuch asks in the 1800s. How can you tell me that the Torah mandates us to go and fight a Melchemes Mitzvah? Now we know there's a concept of the Jewish people going to war. And we know that the Jewish people are supposed to conquer the land of Israel. Correct? Do we all in the room agree that the Jewish people are supposed to be in complete sovereignty over the land of Israel? Does everyone agree to that? Okay. Now, if we all agree to that, how are we supposed to do that? Well, the Torah says this is how you do it. You go out to war, and there's a whole parak in Gemara explaining exactly how you go out to war, and who can be chosen for the army, and when they go out, and what right they have, and can they ask for a peace deal first? There are very clear rules about how the Jewish people are supposed to fight wars. Well, ask the Minchas Chinuch a very simple question. Did you ever hear of a war in the history of the world where one life was not lost? There's no such thing. It doesn't exist. So how can God tell us to go and wage war to capture the land of Israel if in fact we know that there's going to be a loss of life? How can I enlist in an army when I know that there's a chance that either I or my friends will lose their lives? Don't we know there are only three mitzvahs in the Torah that I have to be willing to lose my life for? Israel is a very important thing, but it's not one of those three categories. It's not Avodah Zarah, it's not Gilui Arayos, it's not Shfichas Damim. So why do I have to give up my life for the state of Israel, for the land of Israel? Who said, for a Melchemes Mitzvah, there are always people who are killed? Why do I have to get involved in such a thing? It's not one of the big three. So this is, in my mind, it's an incredible question. It's so obvious. How come no one ever thought of it? Says the Minchas Chinuch, you always thought that there were three mitzvahs in the Torah that you have to give up your life for. Guess what? There are four. Because the definition of a war is that people are going to get killed. That's what happens. Whenever we're engaged in a war, people get killed. And we try to minimize as much as we can, but that is automatically what happens whenever we involve ourselves, unfortunately, in a war that we have to wage. There are always loss of life on both sides. That is what happens. And therefore, says the Minchas Chinuch, if God himself told us that there are procedures, that there are methods in how you're supposed to fight wars, it means that God had in mind also that by doing so, there is going to be a loss of life and you are expected to do so. And you are expected to be willing to give up your life in order to fight for the state of Israel. How amazing is that? How incredible of an insight is that? It's so obvious once you hear it. But it's such an incredible perspective. You think about what a focus, how seriously we're supposed to take this mitzvah, Melchemes Mitzvah. What does it mean to us? We have to be willing to give up our lives. Just like any young child knows, Avodah Zarah, you give up your life. Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim, you give up your life. Eretz Yisrael, you give up your life. To fight a Melchemes Mitzvah, that's the definition of the mitzvah, is to be willing to battle and to put your own life in danger. And when you think about everything that's been going on over the last 60, 70 years, it's clear that it's been one long war, one long Melchemes Mitzvah for the Jewish people trying to gain their own sovereignty over their own land. And until we have that, we are still involved and engaged in a Melchemes Mitzvah, which means that all rules of regular halacha do not apply. Because when it comes to a Melchemes Mitzvah, loss of life is not something that's taken into account. It's not a factor. It's not a factor. And therefore, if I am standing in my own home and I see somebody downstairs who is about to be killed and lose their life, that is part of the war effort. For me to jump in and put my own life on the line, forget about Shalom Melech, forget about everything else. If we are engaged in a Melchemes Mitzvah nowadays, it means we have to be willing to put ourselves in danger in order to help the war effort. Which means, every time a terrorist goes and stabs somebody, kills somebody, shoots somebody, rams a car into a bus station, whatever it is, whenever something like that happens, that is a part, just another leaf in the war that we fight. And for me to get involved, you can hold yourself back and say, well, I'm not going to jump in. Committing suicide is a serious crime. Giving my life up is not something I'm allowed to do. Hanafashas lihena. Don't our lives belong to God? The answer is, yes, they belong to God. But if God told you that to fight a Melchemes Mitzvah you have to be willing to give up your life, then all rules are pushed by the wayside. Then this is something that obviously is governed by completely different rules than usual. And that's why this is something that I believe we really need to take very seriously. When you think about it from this perspective, and you think about how central the land of Eretz Yisrael is supposed to be for all of us, when you think about how much we are obligated and responsible to sacrifice for its safety and for its security, it just, as far as I'm concerned, I think it puts the whole question into a different perspective by delving a little bit into the underpinnings of the questions that are being dealt with on a daily basis in Israel. I think it just gives us a little bit more of an appreciation for the struggles that they're going through, for our perspective and what it's supposed to be, for what Eretz Yisrael is supposed to mean to all of us, not only for those living in the land of Israel, but even for those living here now. And it also gives us a sense of the difficulty that many of the Israeli citizens face every single time they're faced with these kinds of problems. It's not simple answers. These are very complex and complicated questions, and I just felt to give a little bit of a understanding, a little bit of the background into some of these discussions would help us just a little bit. I see we're out of time. So you can look on the back of this page. It's something that everyone can feel free to use over this Shabbos, and Amir Tzashem, we'll get together again next